Okay. So here's an example of the way to set up a so-called graph polarity problem, which is another very well-studied problem. So you have your graph. So your graph has n vertices, and it has n edges. And what is an edge? Well, with respect to the coloring problem, it's a constraint which says that, look, if you have k available colors to color the graph, so the domain of each variable is an integer between 1 and k, then what I'm asking is that each edge encodes the constraint that each constraint is an edge. It picks up two variables and say you can't assign them the same integer. Okay? So that's the coloring problem in general for a graph. Vertices are supposed to take different colors. And the sense in which you have a random graph is that each edge connects two random vertices. Okay? That's what I mean for an edge to be random. It picks two edges, two vertices at random and connects them. Is it clear?
No.
Okay. So, so you have a graph G in general, right? So a graph G is just, I don't know, something like this, maybe. So what does it mean to k-color this graph? It means you have a palette of k-colors with which you're supposed to color the vertices of the graph. You're supposed to paint each vertex with one of your k-colors. And in the graph coloring problem, which was, I think, maybe like the second problem ever proven to be NP-complete, the requirement is that if two sites are adjacent, the colors that they receive are different. Okay? So this is the anti-ferromagnetic K-Potsmann. Okay? So the degree to which your coloring is bad is the degree to which you have spins which you deem to be interacting and which receive the same color. Okay, that's your energy. So what we're looking here is for zero energy states for the anti-ferromagnetic Potts model. Okay, that's the game.
So you're covering the nodes, not here.
Yes, that's right. So we're coloring the vertices of this, the nodes or vertices of a graph. So,
how? The nodes.
Form, also known as vertices.
Yes, same.
I tend to mix these two terms. Okay. So this is graph coloring. So random graphs, at least the most common model for random graphs, is the model that was introduced by Erdos and Rennie in about 1960. So you start with n vertices. No edges. And the way you generate your graph is for each one of the n choose two possible edges, you flip a coin, which comes up heads with a probability p. If it comes up heads, you put in the edge. If it comes up tails, you don't put the edge. That's it. That's the model. It usually goes by the name g n comma p. Okay? So the expected number of edges that you expect such a graph to have is this. Right? You expect that many edges to be in your graph. Okay? And observe that the actual number of edges is a binomial random variable with this many trials and that probability of success, which means it's highly concentrated, which means that in a typical realization of such a process, you're going to have the expectation plus minus order square root of the expectation edges. Okay? Moreover, if you condition on the number of edges and the realization, the graph that you get is uniformly random among all graphs with that many edges. Okay? So what this does is, one way of thinking about it is, this is a complete graph. This is the empty graph. And the layers correspond to the number of edges in your graph. Okay? So you basically are building a measure, kind of looks like this. Okay, and you pick a random point in that measure. Okay? The measure is uniform left to right, and it's highly concentrated up and down. So it is sufficiently concentrated up or down that actually another model you could study is the model in which you actually first pick a level explicitly, M. OK, you're going to have M at it. OK? And then what you do is you just throw those down in formula. OK? And these two models are essentially equivalent. So that other model goes by the name G and M.
So in the first model, you pick an edge to start.
In the first model, what you do is for every possible edge, you flip a coin.
Oh, for every possible edge?
Every possible edge, you flip a coin and it goes in. In the second model, you have to say, I'm going to repeat n times. Pick an edge in the formula. OK? And write it down. Now, one question that arises in the second model is whether you do so with replacement or not. OK? So in my opinion, I think the most interesting regime for random graphs is when the edge probability p is d over n, where d is some constant. And you should think of d as in degree, right? Because the average degree of a vertex is n minus 1 times p. As that goes to infinity, it's basically the same thing, right? So it's average degree some constant.
That's very close to what you get in classes.
That's right. There's a diluted, eh?
Yes, the diluted case.
So I've learned the translation. I don't know any of the meaning, just the formal analogy. What was I saying? Right. So if the total number of edges m is linear in the number of edges, the total number of edges m is linear in the number of vertices m, it doesn't really matter whether you do it with replacement or not.
Is the replacement issue minor or not?
It's minor, yeah. So the number of multiple edges is going to be a Poisson in the limit with finite expectations. So basically, you don't worry about it. So you just, if an edge appears twice, just throw away one of the copies. Another thing which is also easy to get around is, what is an edge? The way we typically think about it, an edge is a subset of two distinct vertices. Okay? Again, you don't really have to worry about enforcing distinctness. You could say an edge is a subset of two vertices. Okay? So this might introduce a number of self-loops. But again, the probability of a self-loop per edge is 1 over n ballpark. You're going to take a linear number of edges. Again, you're not going to be half many. Okay? What's nice is that if you take this sort of don't sweat the small stuff viewpoint, you can now specify your graph, your random graph, as a sequence of 2n IID random variables. Right? Just vertices, just name a vertex, 2n times. And this is an edge, this is an edge, this is an edge, this is an edge. OK? So it's completely independent files. So for some calculations, this is a little bit useful. OK? Does this make sense? So that's what we do here. OK? So in this representation, we have n vertices, we have n edges. And what is an edge? An edge is one of those square boxes, and it just picks two things uniformly at random from the other side. OK? You don't even enforce disjointness. And the requirement is that the two things that you've picked don't take the same value. Well, OK, throw away the ones that really correspond to single, to like soft loops, because for those you can't enforce that. OK? But that, so that's the coloring problem. And as you can see, it's pretty close to case size. So you have n variables, you have n things. One difference is the domains are now k-ary rather than binary. And in KSAT, what we did is, out of the 2 to the k possible values, we forbid one. Here, we forbid a few more as a fraction of the total. Okay? So that's KSAT. So here, I'm also using painting the edges to denote whether you're taking the variable negated or not negated in the corresponding clause.
Well, are you going to tell us when that's hard?
A big part.
Are you going to tell us when graph coloring is hard?
So I said it was the second anti-complete problem, right?
No, but I mean in the random case.
So yeah, I'm about to talk about that.
Okay.
And just to show, the first thing was to show here, there was color right here, case that they look similar. There's other things that look similar. Okay? Not all equal case that is the one in which you demand that in every clause, not only there is at least one literal which is happy, so the OR evaluates true, but you also forbid the possibility that all literals are. Okay? So you now remove 2 out of the 2k possibilities. Also, in coloring, rather than looking into edges which are subset of size 2, and you demand that they get distinct colors, you could look at subsets of size k and demand that they are not monochromatic, that there are at least two distinct colors in this. XOR SAT is exactly k SAT, except that the constraint is at the parity. Okay, it has to be, you know, one of your choice, either odd or even. And this is exactly MDBC codes, low density charity check codes, are exactly random bipartite graphs. Okay. Another thing which is not hard to enforce in this model is regularity. So the way I've been describing it so far is that, let's say, each one of these constraints picks up some of the vertices on the other hand at random. So this is basically a balls and bins experiment, right? From the point of view of throwing these edges on these bins. Which means that some bins are going to be empty, some bins are going to have more stuff. If you want to, you can enforce regularity. You can say that I demand that every variable participates in exactly the same number of constraints. That's not hard. So the way you think of it is, you think of half edges protruding from here, the same half edges protruding from here, and then you just pick a uniformly random matching of those half edges. And it's not hard to prove that this is uniformly random conditional on the requirement of regularity. Okay? So for example, if you wanted to ask the question, okay, how about random k regular graphs? So these are graphs like this, but with the additional constraint that every vertex has to be exactly k, to make it a little bit more lattice-like, but without the geometry. What you do is you go.
I think for this group, it's probably best. I mean, a lot of people haven't even seen KSAT before.
Okay.
But rather than looking at 1,001 variations of the problem,
okay,
you stick with one problem and explain to us how one decides when it gets hard and how this is related to phase transition.
All right. Sure.
Because we only have so much.
Time. Okay. How much time do I have?
It's still 40 minutes.
Yeah, 40 minutes.
40 from now.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let me just say this really quickly. Okay. For colors, so coloring is part of the random case, which means if you have k available colors, you can color random graphs with average degree d, which is no more than that, and you do it again by the naive algorithm. Okay. Just pick a random vertex, assign it a random color until some vertex has only one color left in that. On the other hand, there are no K colorings for twice as high a density. Okay. So at this point, we're in a situation in which we kind of know that it is possible to K color a random graph when the average degree is about 2k log k, which is best you could hope for. But the rate of convergence is very slow. So the average degree has to get enormous before we can hit that 2. And there's some recent progress in this. So it was known that for every average degree d, so d is like, you know, 3.17, there exists an integer such that with high probability the number of colors you need is either k or k plus 1, or that depends. Just on d. Okay, so the chromatic number, the real thing, the minimum number of colors you need was either k or k plus 1. But we didn't have any idea what those numbers are. We knew that there were two consecutive numbers, but that's all. So recently, this was resolved. So we now know exactly, well, up to plus 1, what is the chromatic number of random graph. So what this says is basically, if the chromatic number is 7, then the chromatic number is either 4 or 5. If the average degree is 10 to the 60, then the chromatic number is either this or that. Okay, so we know this now, but we have no idea how to come up with colorings using anything like that number of colors. Okay. So similarly for KSAT, I said earlier there is a conjecture. For a long time we knew that the threshold, if it exists, is somewhere between this number and that number. And if you try increasingly sophisticated algorithms, you could maybe increase this constant a little bit, but we didn't know how to increase this, you know, significantly. So we now have much better bounds. Okay, so the division by k is gone. It's been replaced by a minus k. And the convergence is pretty decent. Like, so if you look at 10 SAT, we know that there are no solutions above this density. There are solutions up to that density, R. And algorithms poop out at 172. Okay, the best algorithm we know. So as you can see, there's a pretty big gap, you know, between the highest density for which, the lowest density for which probably there are no solutions, the highest density for which we can prove that solutions exist, and the highest density for which we can find solutions efficiently.
Wait, provably?
This is provably.
No, for the algorithm.
No, no, I mean.
But I thought that the survey propagation does better. Right?
Yeah, but there's no proofs for survey
propagation. Oh, so that's right. Yes.
Yes, sorry.
So when I say
yes.
Proof, it says no.
Yes, sorry. By best here, I mean algorithm with a proof.
With a proof. Okay.
Yeah. Part of the problem with survey propagation, right, is already at about 6, you can't really run experiments anymore. Like if you try to run experiments with 10 staff, your density is too high to fit all the data in memory. So you have to go to disk. And if you have to go to disk, you're dead. Okay.
So, but for 3-sat, which is, you know, sort of the problem we're interested for any of that. So the lower bound 3.
It's the best lower bound is logarithmic. That's right.
That's algorithmic, and yeah. Is that the proof algorithm you showed us in the morning?
Yeah, it's a relatively naive algorithm. It's basically the algorithm which says, let me sure I get this right. Pick the literal which appears in the most times in the formula.
Okay.
That's it. That's the algorithm.
So that one has that one been improved by this idea of the physicist, or is that not a new algorithm when you
could? No. So the physicist algorithm is a completely different algorithm.
But for 3-sat, do they do better than the 3.5?
Experimentally, yes.
Experimentally. Yes.
There is nothing rigorously known.
Okay.
For the physics algorithm per se. The physics algorithm is motivated by certain hypotheses that the physicists have put forward. So what I hope to prove in the rest of the talk to show you is that some elements of this hypothesis have been substantiated. Not all of them, and even if you had all of them, justifying the algorithm on the basis of the hypothesis is still very hard. Okay, and I think that's pretty much the current state of the art. That's where we're at. Okay. So, I'm happy to explain or discuss later why 3-sat is sort of the wrong problem to look at.
Okay.
You're probably better off looking for theory if you want to look at something like maybe 10-sat or something like that. In some sense, k is 3 is sufficiently small, but there are still edge effects. Okay, going on. It's like as a very vague anomaly, there's something like a critical dimension. There's a critical k, and you probably want to be at a k around 10. So you don't have to deal with some of the amount that k goes
for. What do you mean by edge effect?
No, yeah, okay. Can I take this question so let me, all right. Let me set the following intuition at least, yeah? An easy problem is random n set, okay? So what is random n-sat? Random n-sat is pick a random point in the queue and wipe it out. That's what a clause of left n does. Right? Is this clear? It's a clause of left n. It forbids exactly the one to define it. Right? The one that makes it unhappy. So that's Coupon's collector problem. Right? We have 2 to the n things, and we're wiping them out one by one. The reason this is not interesting is because the encoding of your instance is going to be exponentially big, right? So ksat is the problem of buying coupons in bulk, right? And by bulk, they come in little packages. They come in subcubes. They don't come as random clouds. Yeah?
So maybe. In the proposed adiabatic algorithm, the first step in the proposed adiabatic algorithm is to try to encode the solution in the final Hamiltonian using a cost function, where the cost function of a given test string is the number of clauses it fires.
Yes.
Can your methods tell us anything about the cost function? Or
Yes, although, so, sure. So this is what computer scientists call max ksat, okay? So absolute density about 2 to the k log 2, you can satisfy everything. You can ask what happens if the density is so high. But that's not what you're asking, is it?
No.
She's asking about the distribution of violations. But that's right?
Yes, that's exactly what. And asking, so pick one of these problems. Let's keep the number of variables reasonable. Three SAT, or if you think it's better, let's look at five SAT. Okay?
Now, so third person is no. We've only looked at the problem at zero temperature.
No. This has nothing to do with temperature. The postmaster doesn't have anything to do with temperature.
Okay.
So for each variable, mm-hmm. Okay, if you went, if you wanted to put test all two to the one to the m possibility, okay, so you can define a function which for a given clause is zero if it's satisfied and one if it's not, and you add them up to get the number of clauses that string violates. Okay. Now the implicit assumption is that, not so much using a quantum computer, that physically you can construct efficiently a Hamiltonian that has that cost function as precisely its eigenvalues.
Okay.
And the question is, can you tell us anything about the distribution of those eigenvalues?
No. So far, everything we've studied basically is about ground states. We haven't looked at anything other than ground states.
I mean, basically, the adiabatic algorithm, this automatically makes that if there is a solution, the ground state is a solution.
Right.
And the adiabatic algorithm will find it, but to analyze it, we need to know something about the distribution of the excited states.
That's right. Yeah. So.
Even at zero temperature.
Yeah. I'll say a few things about ground states, which okay, give some hints.
I mean, it would be enough if you just explained the heuristics of what people believe about these phase transitions.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Well, about the critical change from easy to hard instances.
Okay. Let's start here. So what the computer scientists say is that there exists this critical point. Below that point, there are solutions. Above this point, there are no solutions. Okay. And what physicists say, well, there's actually one more really interesting point. And it occurs much below here. Okay. And the reason this is interesting is related to what I was saying here at the end of the previous hour. But basically, up to here, your system has one pure state. Okay? So the set of solutions is sort of convex. It's still not saying anything about non-solutions.
I thought below you typically had many solutions.
That's right. That's what I'm saying.
So what do you mean by one pure state?
It's in the probability sense. It's a pure probability state, non-decomposable state.
No, I think. Can I try to say? I think in the green blob, what happens is if you flip a single bit, you move to another solution.
Pretty much.
And then, or else, excuse me, all the points. The points in the green blob are all connected by single flips.
That's right.
Or a few flips.
That's right.
That's what he means by connected. Mm-hmm. So the separate green blobs to the right of RK star are regions where you have some base point, and then you do certain flips relative to it, and it's little things based on solutions. But then in another green blob, you're very far from it. Is that right?
But that doesn't seem to be satisfying.
It's not clear to me how when you have many solutions you can have a pure state.
He's not using the word quantum state. He's using the word state to mean the space of satisfying a solution.
In the sense, it's in the sense of a linear function. It's like in a Bernoulli process, you have also many realizations which are different.
I guess the question is what So it's a vector over all of these things, which has either ones or zeros.
No, so, okay.
So what is when you say state, what is the state space?
No, it's a subset of the collection of strings that are just satisfied.
Why don't you let me try?
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay, I mean, you have the sequence of zero ones with a certain probability, and the green block, it means that you have almost only ones, and only very, very few zeros.
No.
That's not right.
Okay.
Is it not a question of having a
No.
Okay.
I don't think I know what this is. I think I should, please.
I
know what it is. The green blob represents solutions, strings which satisfy. But they have the property, the reason he draws a green blob. It's because if you take one of each,
but why is he calling that a pure state?
He didn't call it a pure state in a quantum sense. He's using it.
It's not even a pure state. Okay, what's the definition of state?
It's just a collection of strings.
So, first of all, let me say that I copied this slide for the physics.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get that straight. So, step one. Okay, so I'm happy to give you definitions.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say connected components.
Yeah. Yeah.
So look at 0,1 to the end. When you start off, formulas empty, everything is a solution. Yeah. Right? You add clauses, you are removing elements of 0,1 to the end from the set of solutions. So the only thing I know how to discuss to some degree is the evolution of that set. That's the only thing I can give you any information about. Okay? I don't know anything, for example, about the barriers between solutions. Okay? So in your world, there's actually a number which is sitting on every string in 0,1 to the n, which is the energy of the string. And what you really want to know is, if I give you two solutions, what is the lowest line path between the two? Right?
I'm not sure, but I understand what that means.
You want to find out what is the lowest energy barrier, like what is the cheapest, what's the most energy you have to expend? How many, if you start with a solution, and you want to go.
I don't know, but I know what that means.
Okay. So I don't know anything about that. Is the point. Okay? I don't know about the distribution of energy. The only thing I know about is some things about the zero energy configuration. In my mind, the things that I know about the zero energy configurations are suggestive about properties of the non-zero energy configurations, but they're far from theoretical. Okay? So everything I will say will only pertain to the zero energy states. Okay? And what I was trying to get at with the previous slides was that the story I'm about to paint is actually a fairly generic story. It's not terribly specific to KSAT. And moreover, it gets crisper and crisper as K grows. Okay? That's all. So what this does is it says, let's say that two elements of 0,1 to the n are adjacent if they have Hamming distance 1. Okay? So now let's look at the connected components of the set S, which is the set of solutions. Okay. So what this is trying to express is that basically there is one big connected component in the beginning. Okay. It's not really true. Okay. But there really is a very, very big one. You might have some weird things floating around, but they're really, really tiny. They're overshadowed. Okay. Moreover, this connected component really is like a convex set, in the sense that if you pick two solutions which lie in it, and you want to transform one to the other, you can do it by flipping very few bits at the time. It's almost like going and traveling in a straight line. Okay. And the point is that much below the unsatisfiability point, this set shatters. This connect, you go from one connected component to an exponential number of connected components, each of which still contains exponentially many solutions. Okay? Physicists say that this shattering happens at about 2 to the k divided by k times log k. Okay? So remember, we know that there are solutions up to 2 to the k log 2. We know that our algorithms work up to 2 to the k divided by k times some constant C, okay? And physicists say that really, very, very close to this point, at 2 to the k divided by k times log k, this shattering happens. Moreover, I kind of hinted at the fact that if you pay someone enough money, they could make that constant C as big as you wanted. Okay, they would look at a sufficiently elaborate algorithm and they would push the constant a little bit. So intuitively, I tend to think of this log K as some kind of universal constant. Okay? So to me, this is suggesting that all the algorithms the computer system have tried to analyze so far work only when we're in this relatively easy world. Okay, and then they break down. What the physicists have claimed to have done is to come up with an algorithm which works also in this world. When they first came up with the algorithm, they made the claim that they worked all the way to this point. Now they're a little bit more careful about that. They certainly claim that it works, let's say, in the midpoint of this two, which is far, far beyond what any sort of rigorously analyzed algorithm can do. All right?
Is it correct that between log A star and log A, you can decompose your state into pure combination of pure states?
So this is the picture that is drawn by the physicists. It's a very clean picture. Okay. So what I can try to do.
Pure means indecomposable.
Indecomposable.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's what I think. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it means it's a, in the language of statistical mechanics, does that think that it's a unique state?
That's right. Uniqueness of measure.
Uniqueness of the measure.
Okay. Yes. That's what it means. Okay. So what I can try to do is explain in what sense does this phase transition make life difficult for algorithms, and how physicists are trying to overcome this. Yeah. But you know, my real aim is to sort of be maximally useful. So if people have other questions, I'd rather answer those than do this.
I guess I do have one question, well, it maybe has two parts. Maybe the answer is the spin glass. Is this a phase transition? And for fixed K, how big does N, you know, the number of variables have to be before you really get a sense that you're having a phase transition? Something that looks like, you know, it's like you can't really say whether you have a solid or a liquid.
Yeah.
Whether you have ice, you have three water molecules.
Yeah.
So how big does
sure. So with respect to the first question, there is a formal definition, and it does boil down to this business of uniqueness of measure. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the answer to part one. For part two, there is no way that anyone can make the claim that they understand rates of convergence. Okay. But personally, I wouldn't like to hear about experiments with fewer than 10,000 variables. Okay, that's just my personal. And even then, I'm kind of skeptical. Like 100,000 variables would be a lot nicer. Mm-hmm. So, all right.
Can you say something about the fraction of the red ones with regard to the green ones as a function of?
No, like how many metastable states are. More than green, and it depends on the degree of violated clauses that you allow.
Does it go more to the green if you go to the left, and more to the red if you go to the right, or is it a charm?
The ratio of greens to reds does decrease as you move this way. That's what you're asking. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
What did you mean by metastable?
Local minimum. Of the energy function?
Oh, that's what the
reds are. That's what the
reds
are.
Yeah. I mean, I recall hearing a talk by Jennifer Chase. I talked a little bit afterwards, and I got the impression that where people, if critical are, where you thought you had something like a phase transition, people also expected that the solution was unique. Is there a sense in which that is true? Or?
That is definitely false.
Okay.
But it is false, maybe sort of for the wrong reasons. Okay. So what I mean is, for example, okay, when I drew this bipartite graph, we have these balls and pins experiments. So there's definitely going to be variables that don't participate in any plot, which means if you have any solution, you can set these any way you like, and this gives you exponential mean. Okay. So that's the lamest form. You can still have things though, like variables that participate only in one clause. right, also give you a lot of them. So the problem you should really be studying, although it makes life a little bit harder, is regular case set, in which you force every variable to appear in the same number of closes. Okay? So that should help. Even so, I'm not convinced that there is a unique switch. Okay? But I will definitely say something of that flavor about these green blobs. Okay? In other words, we do rigorously know something about the internal structure of these big blobs. Okay? But first, first I would like to give some intuition as to why life becomes hard for algorithms around this point. All right. So the reason is, because this is where what I would call long-range dependencies begin to emerge between your variables. And I'll make this specific, okay? So consider this following sort of like thought experiment algorithm, whose aim is to sample from the set of solutions of the random formula, okay? So imagine you could somehow, rather than approximate, determine exactly the fraction p sub I of solutions in which variable x sub I takes the value 1. Suppose you had a black box. It took as input your formula. And for some variable, any variable of its choice, it told you that variable is true 72% of the time and false 28%. Then you could take a 72-28 coin, flip it, fix the value of that variable to the outcome of the coin, reduce the formula, which means throw away every clause which is satisfied, shrink every clause which just loves the literal, pass it to the box again. Okay? If you do this n times, what you get in the end is not just a solution. In fact, it's a uniformly random solution. Okay? That's easy to see. It's just conditional probability.
What do you mean by it?
It's the uniform measure on the set of all solutions.
On the set of solutions, okay.
Yeah. Of course, the hard part is where the hell are you going to get such a box, right? I mean, at this point, we don't even know a box that will give you a single solution, let alone marginalized. Okay? Well, what you could hope is that you could approximate maybe the fraction of zeros and the fraction of time in which your formula appears positive and the fraction of time it appears negative. And observe that if your goal is just to find the solution rather than to sample uniformly, your approximation doesn't have to be particularly good. The only thing that can go wrong is that one of the variables is forced to always go one way, okay? And you don't detect that. That's the only thing that can go wrong. As long as you have a formula in which every variable can go both ways, depending on the, you know, which assignment you pick, you can make no mistakes, okay? Another thing is the order in which you're going to attempt to set the variables does not have to be determined a priori. It is enough if there is some variable for which you think that you have the marginals approximately right to make progress. In other words, you could imagine passing the formula to the black box, that the black box looks at the formula and says, I'm not very confident about my marginals for this variable, but I'm really confident about my marginals for that variable. You can go ahead and set that one and hope that this might actually help you in setting the marginals the next time around for some other variable. Okay? So what do you do? How do you come up with an approximation? Well, what you do is you start at some variable x1, okay? You look at all the clauses which contain it. You look at all the variables that they contain. You look at all the clauses that they contain, and you keep going. And as I drew earlier, this picture looks very much like a tree, like for quite a while. So now you have x1 sitting, let's say, at the center, and you have this influence thing around it. And what your hope really is that the boundary doesn't have a strong effect on the root. That's what you really hope for. Okay? If that were the case, then you could come up with a decent approximation of the marginals for the root of your tree just by looking at the tree and not worrying about this. Okay? So to make this exact, if you look at some particular instantiation of the boundary, so is it clear what I mean by the boundary? There's a bunch of variables sitting here, right? This is not the whole formula. At some point, you just decide to truncate So there's a bunch of variables that you have here. Imagine that for each possible instantiation of those variables, someone told you exactly the number of ways in which this can be extended to the rest of the formula. Okay? If someone gave you that information for free, then the thing that you are seeking is just this. Okay? Where p sum lambda is the fraction that xi is 1 given this particular number. Okay? Of course, nobody's going to hand you this over. That's for sure. But it turns out that it is enough if someone promised you that there exist real numbers for every variable in your formula, such that the number of extensions to the rest of the formula is proportional to the product of the number. Okay? In other words, that these variables behave essentially independently. Does this make any sense? So this is like saying there is this big formula, it's a random formula, okay? Pick a variable. Now pick another variable. That's it, two variables. So let's say I reveal to you, okay, that my current variable is taking the value 1. So we're leaving some, we have picked some kind of solution, uniformly at random from the set of all solutions. And I tell you that in that solution, x7 is true. Now pick any other variable that you like. Does that have any influence on the probability that this one is true relative to the unconditional measure? Okay? So if you pick a random formula, there exists a number which tells you for every variable in what fraction of solutions is set to true. Yeah? So now you pick a variable, you expect that it takes the value 2 in a random solution with probability what that number was. Now, conditional on that variable taking that value, if you pick another variable, is it true that the probability that it'll take the value 1 is the a priori probability, or has it changed by this condition? Now, if it happens that these two variables are in the same clause, for example, right, then definitely you don't expect that to be true. Okay? But yet, what you would like is that if this is your variable, then the correlation between the value that it takes and the value that some other variable takes drops exponentially with the distance and the shortest path between these two. That's what you're hoping. If someone promised you this, then you could carry through this program. Okay? And you would get pretty decent approximations for the marginals, and you could actually even sample solutions. And what the physicists are saying is that this is really the case when you are in this world. Okay? When the density is sufficiently low, there are no long-range correlations in the formula. Is this making sense or not?
Oh, yes.
Yeah?
What happens in between?
In the other condition. Right.
Right. That's where I'm definitely confused.
So, here's what happens in this world, okay?
Yes.
So one thing which the physicists claimed, and which we now can prove rigorously, is that if you look at each one of these blobs, it has the property that the vast majority of variables in it are completely frozen. Okay? Mm-hmm. So it is not like that, in the sense that most variables have the property that in some assignments take the value 0, and some other ones take the value 1. No. 90% of the variables take only one value inside here.
So it's like a pure phase.
Exactly. Upon conditioning on the frozen things.
It's even more than a pure phase.
It's a very special.
So what they say is that these connected components, so just to make sure that we're sort of mathematically precise at least, okay? So we understand what the connected components are. Okay, so now the claim is pick a connected component and pick a variable and ask what is the projection of the variable of that component. By which I mean, tell me whether the set of values that it takes is a set 0, is it the set 1, or is it the set 0, 1? Okay? Are there truth assignments in this component in which it takes both the value 0 and the value 1, yes or no? The answer is, for 90% of the variables, the answer is going to be no. in this one, let's say x3 is forced to be 0. And so are 90% of other variables. Some are forced to be 0, some are forced to be 1, but they're forced. Moreover, x3 can be forced to be 0 here, okay, and 1 here. So it's not the case that the variable is frozen, it is frozen to the same value in all assignments. Okay? And this is mathematically now provable. Like, this is known. This is what really happens. Okay? Now, another thing that happens is that these green states. Sorry, before I go to that one. So one way of thinking about the state of solutions, about the space of solutions in this regime, like the following is a toy model, but it's a reasonable approximation of what the world looks like. For every variable, you set up a three-phase coin. Okay? So P10, P11, and P1* for variable 1. You have P20, P21, P2*, and so on. Okay? So these three numbers add up to 1 for every variable. So what you do is, in order to generate a cluster, a connected component, you proceed as follows. You flip a coin for each variable with these marginals, and the outcome is either 0 or 1 or star. Okay? So you record the outcome. Let's say star 1, 1, star, star, 1, 0, 0, 1, star. Okay? And then whatever was star, you actually expand to a full cube. Okay, so this is a proxy for the cube that results by keeping the zeros and the ones fixed and turning each one of these things to 0, 1. So if there are k stars, this gives rise to 2 to the k solutions. Okay? Is this clear? So what I'm claiming is that although obviously these three marginals are not identical for all variables, they're very close to one another, and the typical value of the star is about 10%. Okay? So in most clusters, 90% of the variables are completely frozen. Okay? So this we know for a fact. We also know that the Hamming distance between two clusters is big. Okay? So by Hamming distance between two clusters, I mean pick the two strings that are closest, and even those are far apart. Okay? We know that there are exponentially many clusters, and we know that they have exponential size. But their size really is not generic. Their size is the result of, in some sense, picking a centroid and then blowing up around the centroid almost uniformly, almost without any dependencies. Okay?
You mean you have exponentially many clusters even when you get very close to RK?
That's right.
And then it suddenly go from exponentially many to zero?
That's right. Well, you know, there is a scaling. At some point, we have to look at sublinear terms, right? But if you fix an epsilon, you're epsilon away from RK, you have exponentially many. Okay? Moreover, the way, remember I said earlier that these clusters dim as you increase the density, okay? What I mean by dim is that more and more things get frozen. That's the way it really happens. Okay, the way a cluster vanishes is that more and more and more and more and more things get forced. At some point, it becomes a single point, and then a bit later, that point also goes away. Okay?
But the clusters, these ones, for instance, do they have really different sizes?
Great question. So this toy problem is also accurate in the sense that we believe. Okay? So let's ask the following question, just to make it precise. Let a random variable x be the number of non-frozen variables in a random cluster. And just to be even more precise, let's say, put your hand in and touch a solution, a uniformly random solution. Look at its cluster. Look how many things in it, okay, are frozen. The answer is, it behaves pretty much like this. So it is a binomial. which means that some clusters, so although the number of free variables inside the cluster is something like 10% of everything, so you expect that the deviations are within square root of n, so that your first reaction would be to say that all clusters have roughly the same number of free variables, right, or forced variables. That's not quite true, because we remember we have exponentially many clusters. So we live in a large deviation region. Okay? So with exponentially small probability, some clusters will have significantly more free variables than the typical cluster. Right? It's like saying, what's the probability that a binomial random variable with mean 0.9 times n turns out to be 0.8 times n? Right? It's exponentially small. It's e to the minus something of n. But we do have exponentially many clusters. And actually, that is the root cause of the difficulty for algorithms. So if all the clusters had the same size, then actually you wouldn't really need separate propagation. You need propagation root too. So what do I mean by this? Okay. Maybe then I should just stop it. So
no, just round it up.
All right. Okay. So the reason complexity emerges from the point of view of standard algorithms is that if you pick a vertex, you look at, let's say, at the tree of depth 100. When you don't have many clauses, it is reasonable to believe that the marginals of the variables of the leaves are independent. The physicists say that that's not true beyond that point, and that claim is correct. It is not true that they're independent anymore, which means you have long-range correlations, which means you touch one variable here, and your decision spreads throughout the formula. Okay? That's a very scary world to be in. The way they get around it is they say, what we believe, though, is that the locations of these centroids do behave like uniformly random points. Okay? And moreover, we believe that this picture is not recursive. It doesn't happen inside itself. So what they do, what survey propagation does, is can be interpreted as saying, rather than going from the constraint satisfaction problem, which is encoding the set of satisfying assignments to the formula, they set up a new constraint satisfaction problem, the solutions of which encode roughly the centroids of these clusters. Now you can say, how is this possible? And the answer is, it's possible because it is lossy. Some clusters get thrown away, some pseudo-clusters get introduced, but they hope that this is a pretty decent approximation. And by virtue of the fact that in this new problem, there are no long-range correlations, you can actually do marginalization by relatively naive algorithms. Algorithms that pick a variable, look at its immediate neighborhood, and tell you something. That's basically what survey propagation does.
Also,
we've
been on the web.
Yeah, I'm happy.
Are there also references on the
slides? No, there are no references, but I could cook up a few.
So we are a little bit late, but are there some